Welcome back to Witch Hunt, the show where we explore the intersection of supernatural belief, law, and human rights. I'm your host, Sarah Jack.
And I'm Josh Hutchinson. Today we introduce a topic that's as complex as it is controversial. Palai Tukam, a ritual from southern India that's been practiced for centuries, but poses serious questions about child safety and cultural preservation.
That's right, Josh. Palai Tukam involves suspending infants from heights as part of a religious festival, believed by many to bring blessing and good health. However, the risks involved have sparked a significant debate about the welfare of the children participating in this tradition.
And to help us unpack this, we have two very special guests. Joining us is Naveen Suresh, a researcher from Kerala, who's currently doing his PhD focusing on anti-superstition laws. Naveen has spent years documenting and studying the impacts of such rituals on the community and the children.
We also have Dr. Samantha Spence with us, a human rights advocate from the UK who brings a global perspective on how similar practices are viewed and regulated around the world. She's worked extensively on issues related to spiritual abuse in the intersection of cultural practices and child protection laws.
In today's episode, we'll explore the origins of Palai Tukam, discuss its current practice, and dive into the broader implications of maintaining such traditions in modern society. We'll examine the challenges of protecting children while respecting cultural heritage and the roles that education, legislation, and community engagement play in shaping the future of these practices.
We encourage you to join the conversation. Share your thoughts, experiences, or questions with us on social media or via email. We're here to foster a thoughtful dialogue on these important issues.
So stay with us as we navigate the delicate balance between cultural rituals and child safety right here on Witch Hunt.
Let's get started. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Sarah.
Thanks for coming today, Sam and Naveen. We're so happy to get to talk to you about this important stuff.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, Josh. And back again.
Thank you both.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to meet you, Naveen.
It's a pleasure to meet you too, Josh.
Naveen, please introduce yourself and tell us about your background.
Okay. I'm Naveen. I'm from Kerala, state in India. So I'm currently doing my research, PhD research, on anti-superstitious law at Central University of Kerala. So I've done by LLB in Don Manlop College, Trivandrum, and my PhD in Central University itself. So currently my research area is anti-superstitious law. I've taken the subject because I felt that it is highly relevant to talk about anti-superstitious law, and definitely a gray area in the Indian legal system. So I'm also like so many passions, and that passions define me. Teaching is a passion, filmmaking is a passion. Theater, drama, all are fashions that define me. And I also work as a sexuality educator. So we have an NGO which promotes comprehensive sexuality education. So all these fashions define who I am.
Welcome back, Sam. Could you reintroduce yourself briefly?
I can, yes. So I am officially Dr. Samantha Spence, but unofficially, I much prefer Sam. I am the course director for postgraduate law. I am the deputy chair of the National Working Group in the UK on spiritual abuse and possession. And I am a co-director of the Violence Against Women and Girls Hub at the university in the UK as well.
Can you explain what Palai Tukam is and why you're researching it?
Sure. Palai Tukam is definitely a part of my research. I've done a paper on Palai Tukam. It's actually a ritual, which is actually an inhuman practice, which is violating child rights. It happens at Kollamgod. It's in Kanyakumari. It's a border between Tamil Nadu and Kerala. So it's like halfway in Kerala, halfway in Tamil Nadu. So the people are also like half Tamil and half Kerala. So there exists a ritual which is conducted as part of the festival. It's called Kollamgod Tukam. Okay, that's what it's generally called. And one of the rituals among it is Palai Tukam. So in Palai Tukam, what they actually do is that babies who are like less than 1 year old, okay, they're not even 1 year old, they will be like given in the hands of a human being, and that person will be tied to a pole, and it will be a very long pole, and this pole will be like it will be took to a really long height. It's about like 40 meters. It will take in that much high. And then it will be like tied to a rhythm. That's a vehicle. So people will be pulling this vehicle, and it should be pulled around the temple for one round completely. So this ritual happens, it starts from today morning, and it will be like continuously done for one whole day. So the thing is that there are no safety precautions at all. It's a baby being taken to this much height, and they have zero safety precautions. Even an amusement park has safety precautions. But this ritual, it doesn't have any safety precautions at all. And the babies, I could still hear them crying. Okay. So instead of doing it theoretically, I practically went there, took photographs and videos of the ritual. So when I was there, I could literally hear the babies crying. Okay. There was a noise of the people. There was a noise of the trumpets. It was completely a festive mood, but amidst all those noise, I could still hear the babies crying. Okay. And the parents, I was wondered, it was causing a traumatizing experience for me, hearing the babies cry. But I was looking at the parents, and they were chanting some mantras or slogans as a part of the festival. And it was such an inhuman practice, and nobody is concerned. Everybody is promoting it, and even the media, they are live telecasting it, and everybody is involved in it. And it's been there. Even though India is a party to many child rights conventions, all these practices violating the child rights are still going on.
So if you peel back the celebration and just look at what the child's experiencing, it's completely unsafe, unnurturing, and an extensive period of time. And strenuous on them, it sounds.
Yes, definitely. It's definitely causing a mental trauma to them, because I could see them after this ritual is being performed, when the babies are with their parents, and when the ritual is being conducted again in front of them, and when the rhythm or the vehicle is approaching them, they immediately start crying. So that is causing a huge amount of mental trauma to them. And being lifted to this much height by a stranger, imagine that if some health issues happen to that person, okay, suppose he's having BP variation, what will happen to the child? It's completely unsafe. Okay, so this is Pillaithookam, and I was worried what will happen to the child if something happens, but nobody else was worried. Everybody was supporting it. And months later, I published this paper, a similar ritual. It is called Garudanthookam. It happened in another part of Kerala. And a baby was injured as a part of this ritual. Okay, it's a similar ritual, but the baby was injured this time. And the most horrifying or haunting part was that the way society responded to that. Okay, I really thought that even after a baby getting injured, they will try to stop this practice. There were interference from the part of the Child Rights Commission, the police, everybody interfered. But what really happened is that they charged a negligence offense against a person holding the baby. That's the only legal action taken against this. And no actions were taken against the people who actually conducted the ritual. So what happened is that the Child Rights Commission, everybody came in, and they decided that next time when they're conducting this ritual, they will do it with safety precautions. That's the only change that happened even after a baby was injured. So it's really haunting and horrifying.
And the baby fell?
Yes.
Yes. And how high is it that they go up again?
It's different in different places. It's depending on the length of the pole. So this time the baby, it got some injuries, but no big harm was done to it. But it still occurred some injuries. So it's different in different places. Some places, even the method is different. Okay. In some places, the man will be held to the pole using a rope only. In some places, they actually use these sharp objects pierced into the body also. So it's completely different at different places.
What child protections that are in place should be covering this?
See, we like India is a country that should value child rights protection. See, we are part of all the international conventions regarding child rights, and we have like legal system, so many laws protecting the rights of the child. But the problem in India is that we have legislations, we have enough legislations to combat all these things. But the problem is that whenever it comes into the arena of religion, everything becomes extinct. No law is good enough to touch the arena of religion. Even judiciary refrains themselves from touching the area of religion. That's a major issue here. And that's the relevance of an anti-superstitious law, which should deal specifically on these practices. So in India, like, suppose if I'm getting proper education from schools, I will be like learning about the Indian constitution by 10th standard, maybe. I'll be learning in detail about the Indian constitution by reaching 10th standard. But right from my birth, I will be like exposed to the world of religion right from the birth. Okay. So I'll be like forced to, like, we don't have the like right to choose my religion, actually. Whatever the religion of the parents, they will force it on us. And in most of the religions, like, it will be like taught from a childhood itself that it will be a great sin if you don't follow the religious procedures, religious rituals. So when I'm exposed or trained to be a religious individual right from childhood itself, it is very difficult to talk about scientific temper in India. Scientific temper is there in the constitution, but whether this word actually and practically exists in India, it's a very difficult thing. Scientific temper is something that we really lack. The society lacks it completely. And we follow something like blind religious beliefs can be easily seen everywhere. So no matter how much education a person acquires, it doesn't help him to see through religion. Okay. That veil will be existing always. So education system is also becoming ineffective in dealing such issues. So where should we start? That's a question. Education can't provide scientific temper. Parents can provide it. The state is not able to provide or promote scientific temper. So how are we supposed to earn it? The question.
Now, I pick up on something that Naveen's just said there for international as well. It's that it's not always about the absence of laws. Sometimes there's too many laws. It's about the lack of clarity in the laws, how they're applicable to these practices and whether they are actually enforced, which is usually the main one. They're not enforced. So there are anti-superstition laws in India and child protection laws, and you have international treaties, so the Convention on the Rights of the Child. But what also happens is these laws don't really interconnect with each other and back each other up. And we see many states, India is definitely one that signs up to conventions like CEDAW on women's convention. But there's no real teeth in these conventions to apply that international force, if that makes sense. It goes back to political will. And if states don't want to play the game as such, then they won't, because there's no international police force. So I think there's a lack of clarity internationally. Yeah, we've signed up to this. So what? What does it do? And that's always the problem. And I think I've said this before, it's this top-down, bottom-up approach that we're working internationally to raise awareness, but we need to educate and raise awareness as well, like Naveen said, in the societies that we're talking about here, and try and get that through to permeate through society. But it's very, very complicated and very complex in that arena on the ground. And I think a lot of that as well is fear, because as has been said, people don't want to discuss this. It's very political in India at the minute. So you're on, do you know what I mean? Dangerous ground. But all we can do is keep talking about this and keep raising the awareness. And like I said, the laws are sometimes more often than not in place. They're just not working, not enforced. And we need to create awareness of how we do that. But that has to come through the system, from the lawyers to the judiciary. And again, you've got major corruption now and fear. So difficult.
There's a lot of barriers here. So with
your research, you're pointing out essentially how this ritual may be harmful to a child, but then you also have to get those conversations and recognition happening so that change can happen for these kids.
But you've got to want change as well. And I think that's the other issue, is that some of these things are so deeply entrenched that actually change isn't wanted by everyone. So how do you tackle that? I mean, that's the same with the witchcraft element and other harmful practices. If the parents see this as something that they should do, and it's a generational issue, then that's going to continue.
Also, the problem is that, like, it's an irony, actually. Like, they are doing this in human practice, which is completely unsafe. The, like, myth behind it is that they are doing this for the child to have a better health, okay? So the reason why they are performing this ritual is to ensure that the child will have a better health. And do we really need to do something unsafe to provide better health for the child? I definitely don't think that it is going to provide any form of better health to the child other than the mental trauma.
And there are anti-superstition laws in place. Should those laws be applied to this and to other harmful traditional practices?
Okay, there are, like, yes, Sam, you
began. No, I was going to say there's two elements there, and this was raised recently when I was in Kerala. There's anti-superstition laws and there's witchcraft laws, and they always get a lot together, but actually they're different. So the witchcraft laws specifically aimed at this as a harmful practice, anti-superstition laws are more broader. How you then rectify that within a pluralistic place like India, again, is problematic, and whether it can be incorporated in, which I'll pass over to Naveen now.
Okay. So there are, like, 8 states in India having anti-superstitious state legislations. But are they really anti-superstitious legislations is a question that we should raise. Okay. Most of them, as Sam said, are witchcraft laws. Okay. Witchcraft, magic remedies, black magic acts. So these are the legislations. So first of all, we lack a national legislation which could unify all these legislations. So there is absence of a national legislation. And the second question is whether these state laws are effective. Okay. One essential thing that we should discuss is that, like, it's about describing or defining what the concept of superstition is. It's definitely not an easy job. Okay. Kerala might be having different superstition. Other states will be having different superstitions. So how to, like, narrow down what are superstitious practices and what are not superstitious practices? The problem is that if we just inculcate the concept of scientific temper, most of the religious practices should be banned. Okay, that's a problem. All these religious practices are lacking scientific temper. So we can't, like, measure it with the scale of scientific temper completely. So how will we define what is a superstitious practice and what is not? So that requires a huge amount of study, identifying and recognizing the practices. So some of the practices, what happens is that, for example, there was a practice called Talikuthal, which exists in Tamil Nadu. There are studies saying that Talikuthal exists as a part of a cultural ritual. So it speaks about killing the elderly people. Okay, they'll just, the family will be trying to kill the elderly people. That is Talikuthal. So if you research about Talikuthal, nobody acknowledges the existence of Talikuthal. They're saying that it doesn't exist. Okay. But it is still happening. There are interviews and documentaries of people who actually perform these rituals. There are, like, persons who actually conduct these rituals. The thing is that whenever the state is trying to interfere, normally it doesn't interfere, but if the state tries to interfere, the society immediately closes the doors and says that it doesn't exist. So it is very difficult to make them recognize that, okay, if you take the case of Pillai Thookam, the parents are performing it. So it's not something performed by a stranger. The parents are forcing their own children to do it. So if a parent can see a harm is being caused to the child, who else can? It's very difficult to convince them that this is a superstitious practice and it should be banned. And in a state like India, in a country like India, where democracy rules, it is very difficult for the political parties to interfere into matters of religion. So actually, legislature is hesitant to interfere in matters of religion. Executive is hesitant. Judiciary is hesitant. So everybody has a fear, like it is a matter of religion. Because religion has an unquestionable authority in our state. Nobody can question religion. So since that unquestionable authority exists there, it is very difficult to bring in a legislation which could actually prohibit this in human practices.
You've mentioned witchcraft very briefly in this episode, but we've spoken on it before on other episodes. What are some common myths related to witchcraft and mental health that are prevalent, and what is their origin?
Those asked for me, isn't it? The link with mental health and witchcraft is that there is fear and misunderstanding about what mental health is. So it's the unknown, and anything that's the unknown becomes something to be scared of. And this leads to stigma, discrimination, violence, and the witchcraft. So mental illness as a sign of witchcraft is one of the myths. So the belief that people are possessed by evil spirits or they have these supernatural abilities and that makes them as witches. And that's traced back through generations, through history, because, again, there was a lack of understanding of what caused these issues there. And this is all across the world as well. There's also, if we turn that around, the myth that witchcraft itself can then cause mental illness. So we have this, it could be a curse, or because you've done something, you've engaged in witchcraft, that has actually brought on the mental health. And then on top of that, you have the actual cure for mental health lies in witchcraft. So the belief that actually these witchcraft or spiritual remedies can cure the mental health. So it's all very interlinked, but it comes back to the fear and misunderstanding and the stigma of mental illness. That's really what propels it all there. But it's very complex in the way that it's used, because it's used in three different ways there. And they all contradict each other in a way. So, yeah. And also the lack of medical treatment, the lack of medical access in communities means that they go to traditional healers. And then you've got the propagation there that continues for usually money. And that is an issue. So, yeah.
So how does the mental health professional community address this for individuals and address this for families and communities?
Again, it's education. I think if you explain what something is and how it's caused and the actual medical science, the science behind this, then you are trying, and I'm not saying that this works because you can have the science there and people will still not believe it, but this promotion of mental health literacy, what is mental health? How do we describe it in a culturally sensitive way as well? And how do we offer evidence-based care and not this kind of traditional care or witchcraft care, but understanding that mental health is not linked to superstition, it's not linked to witchcraft, it's not linked to the devil, it's actually a disorder, a health as a physical one would be, is something that needs to be get out there. And it's for communities to work together and with mental health practitioners to try and dismantle these harmful stereotypes that perpetuate. So again, you've got that battle there, and make sure that mental health is actually understood firstly and it's treated with compassion as opposed to being stigmatized.
Is there a link to the witchcraft myths, mental health misunderstandings to these gruesome crimes that are occurring in some communities?
Yeah, there's always the link is there is mental health. A lot of the time, so if I talk about the UK, for example, the cases in the UK of Christy Bamu, and he was a 15-year-old boy and he wet the bed and they believed that he had the devil inside him. And it's this thing that he was beaten to death in a brutal way. And the problem is there is that once you start to supernaturalize it, it removes the human being. And I've seen many a video, unfortunately, that children and women have been beaten because they can't feel it because they're possessed. And that's the danger there, that people actually dehumanize the person, and the harm becomes aimed at this spirit that, well, not there. So yeah, it's massive, but it's fear. And going back to what Girish said as well, it's all linked, religion, superstition, is because it all runs off fear. That's how it works. Fear of the unknown, fear of what's going to happen, fear of society, fear of rejection, fear of stigma. All there, and it's clever. It's very, very clever, and it's also dangerous. But how you challenge that? You're challenging the systems that want to maintain the status quo because it suits that, especially in India. So how do you challenge that? And the ones that do challenge it, again, are putting yourself up there. You're putting yourself out there to, what's the word? Be attacked, I suppose.
I'm just adding on to what Sam just said. Be it an educational institution, be it a working place, the mental health of a person should be given first priority. But unfortunately, mental health has been given zero importance in our entire system. See, for example, if you are like in an education institution, the children are asked to follow strict discipline. Okay, they have been given strict treatment. They have been not to talk, not to run, not to do anything at all. So they are being silenced. Okay, their voices are being silenced. They are prohibited from thinking critically. And they will be like pressurized with too much academic work. And whether these academic works are effective is another question. The major concern is that like these pressure that is being put on them is causing serious mental harm to them. And also like we consider like arts and sports as extracurricular activities. That should not be. It should be part of the curriculum. These are all connected. Okay, arts, sports, academics. It should be connected completely. So it should not be considered something extracurricular. So when all these factors which should positively contribute to the mental health of a person are absent. For example, if you take the case of a working place, we say that, okay, too much work exploitation is there. So suppose we are being forced to work for extra hours, we are forced to work or forced to do something that we are not capable of doing it. See, different individuals are different, right? But everybody is forced to do the same thing, be it in an education system, be it in a working place, everybody is being forced to do the same thing. So all these factors are negatively affecting the mental health of a person. So when these serious mental health issues happens to the people, they are looking out for methods to ventilate themselves. Sadly, everybody can't afford the help of proper mental health professionals. We also have, here there are people who still doesn't recognize the difference between a psychologist and a psychiatrist. People doesn't know. If somebody visits a psychologist, we have a stigma that, okay, that person is having some serious mental health issues. So that stigma exists within the society. So when all these stigmas are existing and when all these mental health problems are there, the only form or the only solution available to the common man is go to a religious place and worship. That is the only form of ventilation, affordable form of ventilation available to them. And that makes them more ardent believer of religion. And that gives that unquestionable authority. So mental health is a serious problem and that should be dealt with in a serious manner.
So if I was wondering if a public program were offered to provide psychiatric services to individuals as part of their healthcare, would that help to alleviate the problems of going to traditional healers for treatment?
Obviously, see, the method to combat this problem actually is, suppose if I'm saying that I'm an atheist, I'm against the religion, I will get an instant repulsion from all these believers. Okay. They won't listen to whatever I preach. Okay. They'll immediately say, oh, that person is an atheist. Oh, that person is against religion. So we should not listen to that person. So the only form to get inside that sphere and actually combat that problem is that we cannot go directly against religion. We cannot go to a hand-in-hand combat with religion. That's not the way. But there is another method which is put forward by Dr. Narendra Dabolkar. He's like the person who had led the anti-superstitious movement in India, but was unfortunately murdered for the work that he had done. But what he put forward, Narendra Dabolkar said that this is not a fight against religion. This is just an attempt to inculcate scientific temper in them. Okay. So if you try to inculcate scientific temper, if you try to provide effective alternate means like proper psychologist help, okay, if you provide them with that alternatives, they will slowly distance themselves from religion. That's what I feel. Okay. See, I was brought in a religious family and I have followed all these religious practices in childhood. But what made me distant to religion is the realization of the inhuman practices that was happening and my exposure to scientific temper. That helped me realize it. Okay. So we should develop the ability of critical thinking from childhood itself. Nobody is beyond question, be it God, be it political party. Nobody is unquestionable. We should be taught to question everything. And if we are taught from childhood to question things, then slowly these practices might recede back. That's what I think about it.
Yeah, we need to be questioning how we're treating people. I mean, one-on-one, how groups are treating other groups. You have, you know, used the word inhuman several times today, and that's really impactful because any behavior that is reducing somebody to an inhuman status isn't okay. And that has to be recognized by people.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'll just, I agree with what Naveen's just said completely. And you can't fight against the religious movement as such. You have to work together with the religious movement to try and improve the situation there, which is problematic. However, it is possible. And like I say, this critical thinking is so important to ask the questions, but why is it? Who said, can you tell me from a young age? Because indoctrination happens at a young age. And if you introduce critical thinking at a young age, you then start to counteract the other one and to ask these questions. But unfortunately, in some societies, it's so regressive and you are in an environment where you are unable to ask those questions. And that raises its own problems.
Does the rationalist movement have a way of working with religious society?
Unfortunately, that is absent. So what happens in India mostly is that, like, if somebody like overcomes the barrier of a religion or somebody lifts the veil of religion, that person immediately becomes an atheist. Okay. He'll be suddenly talking against religion completely. So this results in a tussle of war between atheist and religious groups. And nobody wins. That's what happens. So it's not like we should understand the situation. There is no perfect solution which is applicable everywhere. We should definitely understand that. A solution which is applicable in one state will not be the solution that will be applicable in another state. So we should understand what the scenario is, what the problem is. We should not just invalidate the religious people. Okay, they are religious people. So we should just invalidate them. No, that's not the way to do it. We should identify why they are following it blindly. We should identify the reasons for it. So they are also humans. So there will be humane reasons that force them to do that. So identifying the reasons and working on the grassroots level, just for example, just like Josh remarked earlier, provide them with proper mental health measures. Okay. If they talk to a proper psychologist, okay, if the psychologist is able to give them a better ventilation method, then they won't be, it is not necessary for them to visit a temple. They are identifying or they are realizing that there is another effective alternative. So provide them help. It's not, we should have empathy towards them too. So without empathy, no rationalist movement won't work. That's what I would say.
Yeah, and also on the back of that is to educate about, it's not about the beliefs. It's about the harm that comes from that belief. So people have freedom of belief. You believe whatever you want to, that's absolutely fine. But what that doesn't give you the right to do is to harm another human being. And that's basically where we are there. Everybody will have different beliefs, a spectrum of beliefs. Again, absolutely fine. But you can't cross that line. And many of these practices do cross that line within the boundaries of, oh, well, this is, it's cultural, it's religious. And that's when it's not acceptable.
Yeah.
There is this problem, Sam had remarked about child right practices and parents, involvement of parents. So while combating all these inhuman practices, it can be done in a step-by-step manner. For example, if an adult is performing a ritual, okay, which is causing harm to his health, it's very difficult for the law to interfere in it and say that you can't do it. It's very difficult because it falls under his consent. He is doing voluntarily. But in the case of a child, you can't do that. The child is not in a position to give consent. So it's the parents who are asking the child to do that. The child right conventions clearly states that it is not a concept of parental ownership, but the concept of parental responsibility. So the parents are supposed to do all these acts in the best interest of the child. It's not what the parents think it is the best interest. It is what that should be in actually the best interest of the child. Okay. It's not that the parents could decide everything for them. If the parents think that this is best, no, that's not the way. We should see it from the perspective of the child also. We should be able to analyze the problems from the arena of child rights too. So if we are able to see, first of all, parenting should be taught. I personally feel that parenting should be taught. Okay. In India, anybody can become a parent. At any age, it's very easy. If you're an adult person, you can easily become a parent. No, it's not something that anybody can be a parent, or it's not something that anybody can do. Parenting is a serious task, and it should be properly taught to them. Okay. Then they will identify the importance of parental responsibility. And I really hope that then they will not allow their child in such unsafe places.
What role do media and entertainment play in perpetuating stereotypes and misunderstandings about mental health across different cultures?
So in Kerala, like caste system existed and slavery existed. All those inhuman practices existed in Kerala. So we have overcome all these practices mostly through art movements. Revolution happened in Kerala through art. Okay. Art is the best means to get to the common man. And we can, like, a cinema or a drama can, like, speak volumes. It can easily communicate to them. Suppose another problem is that if we go to the general public and talk about scientific tempo or theories or scientific principles, they won't be able to understand it. Okay. It should be given to them in a medium which they find it amusing, which they find it interesting. So media plays an important role. And that is a exact reason why, I told in the beginning that my passion is filmmaking. So everything is connected. My research, filmmaking, everything is actually connected. So that's the reason why my first short film, it's titled as Avarnan, that means the colorless person. So it was talking about normalizing discrimination. The problem is that in our society, discrimination is normalized, be it gender discrimination, be it caste discrimination. All these discriminations are done as something normal. here it is done this way. That is the famous dialogue that we used to say, okay, in India, it is done this way only. So that should not be done. Okay, that should not be done in that way. Because discrimination, be it in any form, that cannot be treated as something normal. It is completely abnormal. So that was the message that I tried to convey it with my film. So if we are able to make good films, good skits, street plays, all these can help us communicate all these principles effectively to the people.
Are you able to develop a curriculum into your film?
All these should be connected. See, instead of like writing assignments in lots and lots of paper, like, and giving traditional lectures to the students, they should be given opportunities to utilize all these mediums to express what they want to state to the public. Okay. It should be, they should be given opportunities actually. So with my film, I was able to talk to many people. Many people after listening to it, they have talked to me about all these problems they have faced in it. It was relatable to them. So the advantage of media is that it makes a connection with the audience, and this relatability factor actually works. Okay. So teaching using media, allowing them to create such content, all these will definitely help them. So it should be part of the curriculum. It should be part of all these rationalist movements which are trying to wipe off the menace of superstitions.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful.
Thank you so much. It's been a real honor to have this conversation with you today.
End Witch Hunt started to track past and present legal cases in the United States where the vulnerable are victims of harmful practices because they are believed to be possessed by an evil spirit. Over the course of 3 months, we have documented 50 cases, 3 of which are getting set to go to trial. One of those cases is that of 3-year-old Areli Naomi Proctor, whose mother and uncle thought she was possessed because Areli was screaming during the night. Instead of seeking medical attention, her mother and uncle brought her to a local church where her grandfather was the pastor, and the 3 performed an exorcism which ultimately led to Areli's death. The 3 have pleaded not guilty in Santa Clara County, California. The judge will make the decision whether or not this case will go to trial on May 13th. We will keep our audience posted.
Welcome to an important update from End Witch Hunts. Today, we're rolling out a new initiative tracking spiritual and ritual abuse, SARA, in the United States. Essentially, we're starting a project to keep track of these abuses because, surprisingly, there's currently no central system for doing so. Our aim is to gather data and raise awareness by sharing the stories of those affected. What does this have to do with witch hunts? When people are believed to be possessed, accusations of witchcraft can arise against the supposedly possessed or those accused of causing the possession. This often results in spiritual and ritual abuse, including harsh exorcisms and other harmful rituals. Now let's clarify what SARA means in this project. It's not tied to any one religion. Instead, it covers any harmful rituals practiced within any faith that hurt vulnerable individuals. Our project focuses solely on collecting data and spreading awareness. We're not offering legal aid or direct victim support. The idea for this project came about during an expert workshop where we learned about the prevalence of SARA in the UK and realized the urgent need for similar data in the US. Right now, we rely on media reports to identify potential cases, which helps us understand the extent and nature of these abuses. In the US, SARA isn't just about well-meaning traditions that inadvertently harm people. It also involves controlling or coercive rituals where abusers misuse their power to manipulate and harm victims, often under the guise of socially respected spirituality or culture. These behaviors can range from isolating victims to exploiting their vulnerabilities and even conducting unsanctioned exorcisms, which is leading to the death of children.
Speaking of exorcisms, whether they're sanctioned or not, if they cause harm, they're considered spiritual and ritual abuse. Sadly, we are identifying several cases in the U.S. where exorcisms have led to severe injuries and death. It's crucial to recognize that these victims aren't demonic entities, but real people subjected to dangerous practices. Spiritual and ritual abuse isn't just happening within families or homes. It's also occurring within some institutions and religious communities, leading to fatal outcomes at an increasing rate. Our goal with this project is to shed light on the frequency of these abuses and raise awareness. Tracking potential cases is enabling us to create foundational analytical data for understanding the extent and nature of these abuses in the United States. As we wrap up today's discussion on Pulaitukam and the broader issues of child safety within cultural rituals, we'd like to thank our guests, Naveen Suresh and Samantha Spence, for their insightful contributions and for shedding light on such a complex topic.
Absolutely, Sarah. It's conversations like these that remind us of the delicate balances we must maintain between honoring our traditions and protecting our future generations. We hope this episode has provided you with a deeper understanding of the challenges and the potential pathways toward more humane practices.
Please continue this conversation in your communities and online. Visit our websites for links for more resources on this topic and to share your thoughts and stories with us.
Have a great today and a beautiful tomorrow.